so I had my Bible open to Genesis 1. That was the beginning of the Torah cycle, and Amnon called me and explained the situation with the flights and all that, and asked me, you know, would I cover the service this night and come up with a message? And I'm thinking, well, it's right in front of me. Genesis 1:1. So I dug out my notes and put this together, and I wanted to share some thoughts about the existence of God, reasons for faith. Now, most of us, well, I think everybody here, we're Bible believers. We could just start with, in the beginning, God, stop, put in an exclamation point, let's go eat. Am I right? yeah, I'm hungry. That's right. But I also wanted to put a subtitle on this, a reasonable alternative to the non-existence of God. That's for those that are more philosophically oriented. Can God's existence be proved? Well, proof is a rather subjective commodity. First of all, God's existence cannot be proved in a mathematical or scientific sense. Now, the scientific method, as important as that is to us, has limitations, and a lot of folks forget this. The basic scientific method is you have a controlled environment, you have one variable that you're trying to measure the outcome of, an observation's made, data is drawn, and your hypothesis is verified empirically, and it's repeatable. That's the fundamental scientific method. So, for example, if I wanted to prove the premise that ivory soap floats, I can prove this scientifically. Yeah. I get an aquarium, I fill it with water, I have a clipboard, I have someone here that's writing down the attempts and the outcomes, and I drop in a bar of ivory soap and it floats. And then we repeat it. And we do it again and again. And at the end of the study that the government just paid me $80,000 for, I can absolutely, conclusively show the evidence is 100% of the time ivory soap floats. Now that's, I can publish my findings in the scientific journals, make a lot of money doing that, and then other scientists can replicate the experiment and validate my conclusions, and that's just a wonderful thing. The limitation, however, of the scientific method is that by the same scientific method, I can't prove what I had for lunch 2 weeks ago. It's impossible. That's a historic event. Historic events cannot be proven by the scientific method. That's only applicable for things that can be repeated in the presence of the same set of circumstances. So for historical events, we have to look at evidence and testimony, and then we question reliability and all that. Now, instead of that question in a scientific sense, we should ask, if belief in God's existence is reasonable. I think that's a good place to start. Now, Josh McDowell, in his book, Evidence That Demands a Verdict, which should be on everybody's bookshelf, if it isn't, you should get it, like tomorrow. He says, faith is the assurance of the heart in the adequacy of the evidence. I love that. It's not biblical, but I like it. It really speaks to the core issue. Now, the problem is with the scientific method is we can observe phenomenon and come to wildly different conclusions. About 3 years ago, my wife and son and I made a trip to Chicago. We got to spend a lot of time with my mom. We also made a point to go to museums there. Chicago has some fantastic museums if you haven't been there. And one of the museums we went to was the planetarium. Well, while we were there, I bumped into this display, and it was about a guy by the name of Christoph Scheiner, S-C-H-E-I-N-E-R, if you want to Google it. He's a relative of mine. I knew about this. In 1611, the same year the King James Bible came out, Christoph Scheiner was a mathematician and an astronomer. Now, he was a contemporary of Galileo. Unfortunately for the Shiner legacy, he was on the wrong side of the arguments. Shiner was a Jewish man who converted to Catholicism and became a Jesuit of all things. And because of the Jesuit philosophy, they were buying into the other side of the coin and the arguments of things and cosmology. What does that mean? Shiner attempted to rescue the imperfection of the sun by saying that little sunspot that you see on the suns, he observed sunspots in 1611 through the telescopes. His argument was that these weren't from the sun, because the sun has to be perfect to conform to Catholic theology. So he said they were shadows of satellites that were revolving around the sun. Well, Galileo correctly rebuked him. Shiner also opposed Copernicus for holding the true heliocentric theory of the universe, that the sun is the center, not the earth. So on two counts, he blew it. So as a kind of a personal goal here today, I'd like to restore some credibility to the Shiner clan for the errors of our predecessor. So forgive me my thing. What is life without God? Each of us will one day grow old, die, and our bodies disintegrate. I have a startling statistic I read. This may shock some of you. The death rate is still one per person. We all gonna die. But if there is no God, then if the moral and the immoral eventually come to the same end, what does it matter how we live? What's the point? Let's just go out and party, eat, drink, and be merry. Party on, dude. I mean, I'm gonna live for self. Been there, by the way. Life without God, listen to what one person describes this. This is frightening to me. No species, ours included, possesses a purpose beyond the imperatives created by its genetic history. We have no particular place to go. Is that not sad? That is a sad, empty, purposeless existence. If we've got no place to go, what is the point? I'd be depressed. So, evidence for God. We're going to take a look at some arguments. Some of you are familiar with these. The cosmological argument, I'll explain that. The teleological argument and the moral argument. Now, the cosmological argument answers this question, or asks this question: why is there something rather than nothing? We're here observing something. It's all here. There's something here that we're observing. Why? Why is it there rather than absolutely nothing? So a good inductive argument is this: if anything now exists, something must be eternal, or something not eternal must have emerged from nothing. Really? We're running into a scientific problem already. We think of the vastness of the galaxy. There's amazing stuff out there. Why? Where did it come from? How do we explain this? Cosmology comes up with the Big Bang. The technical question, or the technical representation of this, is a horrendous space kablooey. The Big Bang. Are you kidding me? So the universe began as a particle that was infinitely dense and occupied no space. Right off the bat, we have a clue. The very necessary premise for this is invalid by the very laws of physics. We're not even talking religion. I haven't even mentioned a Bible verse. The very known laws of physics refutes this very premise that a particle could be infinitely dense and occupying no space at all. It's impossible. From just basic physics. So we're not dealing with science. We're dealing with man's philosophical presupposition. Philosophically, The notion of a beginning is repugnant to me. I should like to find a genuine loophole. At least the guy's being honest. We must allow evolution an infinite time to get started. We're not dealing with science. This is a philosophy dictated by an anti-supernatural bias hiding behind scientific terms. It sounds scientific, but it's not. It's flawed. So, let's play this little logic reason game with the scientists and philosophers. Is it more reasonable to believe that something spontaneously emerged from nothing? That's one option. Two, the universe is eternal. That's the second one. Three, the universe is an illusion. Or four, the universe is created and therefore finite. There's only four possibilities to explain the existence of the universe. It's only four possibilities. So let's go through these. Is the universe something that arose spontaneously out of nothing? Well, this is where we get the Big Bang Theory. They talk about, well, it's a couple of little, really tiny hydrogen atoms that kind of collided and then, boom, started this space kablooey, right? Where did they get the hydrogen atoms? We have eternal hydrogen atoms? Where did those come from? If I want to do another little experiment here, I have an empty box here. And inside this empty box, I use a vacuum and I pull out all the air. There's nothing in the box. Now, I can heat the box. I can cool the box. I can shake the box. I can subject it to alternating current, DC current, different voltages. I can expose it to X-rays, gamma rays. I can do all kinds of experiments. But you know what happens when I open the box? It's empty. It's empty. A basic law of physics is from nothing, nothing comes. So if we start at the absolute starting point of nothing, the theorists have a significant problem. See, this requires more faith to believe in what they're asserting than it does to believe in the existence of a God that created the laws that govern what we can observe. They're not supposed to have that kind of faith. They criticize us for faith, but man, it takes a lot more faith to buy into their theories and their premise. Is the universe eternal? And life is just a product of chance. Well, it's always been there, so eventually it had to happen, right? This is the steady state theory. It's always been there. Always been there. Well, there's a problem. Again, I would appeal to what's called the second law of thermodynamics, which states that all matter is tending toward entropy. Whatever starts at one level of energy is losing energy. The universe is running out of energy. The sun is cooling off. Greater temperatures tend to lesser temperatures. Pluto and Uranus are encased in ice. I just filled up my Kia and it cost me $40. I wish that thing had an eternal gas tank, but no. It needs to be replenished, just like the universe. There's no filling station. It's running down of energy over time. The second law of thermodynamics stands. Is life the product of chance? Well, assuming that it's always been there, or a really long time, neither of which I'm willing to grant that premise, but they say, well, statistically, life must have happened. I mean, over a long period of time, it just had to have happened. It just the chance, random things create life. What is statistical probability? It's a constant tabulation of the same thing happening all the time. Pick up a set of dice and roll it. What's the odds of rolling a 7? I don't know, but there is some odd. Well, what's the odds of rolling it again? And again, and again, and never not rolling a 7. You see, whatever chance creates, chance destroys by the next roll of the dice. So to argue that life happened by chance doesn't work. Whatever chance creates, chance destroys. So the very processes that they say are involved in the creation of life, if it was a random act, it would have stopped. Maybe it started again, but then it stopped. But we don't see that. There's no evidence of that. We see a continuity of life. Number three, is the universe an illusion? There are people who believe this. Some people need meds. But there are people who philosophically, Christian Science, Hinduism, they use the word Maya for illusion. Solipsistic philosophy, I had to look that up, it is spelled right. I'm not that smart. Solipsistic philosophy believes this, that essentially the only reality that exists is that which I perceive in my own mind. Does that sound familiar? Have you heard variations of this? Very New Agey thing, you know? Well, that's not my reality. Really? What's reality? You see, this is life built on the denial of objective evidence. Well, this real world, it's really not real. So it doesn't matter. Even the Christian Scientist who might believe that still looks both ways before they cross the street. Because that truck coming ain't no illusion, baby. It's going to take him out. So it's a little bit disingenuous. You see, reality exists independently of our perception of it. How do we know this? Predictability. Halley's Comet in 1910 came right on time. And the astronomers predicted, oh, it's going to come back in 1985. Guess what happened in 1985? Halley's Comet came back. It's on an elliptical orbit. What does that mean? It means that this is something that is not just chance. It's not an illusion. An illusion can't happen like that, not with predictable events that are scientifically validated. An illusion, what is an illusion? An illusion exists in the mind of the person suffering from it. So if someone has a different view of reality, pray for them. Maybe they're off their meds. But it doesn't validate their position. Interestingly, the scriptures tell us after Yeshua's resurrection, he was witnessed by over 500 people. Scriptures tell us that for a reason. I think it's kind of cool. It's not just a few people. They were just deluded or they made it. No, 500 people saw him. That's not an illusion. Now, the only thing left, the only reasonable option, in my opinion, is was the universe created and therefore finite? Absolutely. It's the only reasonable option left to explain the existence of the universe. Radium has a specific half-life and ends up as lead. Second law of thermodynamics holds true. Radioactive carbon dating, nuclear fission dating, although wildly inaccurate, nonetheless tell us the same thing, that energy is being lost over time. It's not being replenished. So we are faced with a finite universe running down, which had to have an origin greater than itself. There's the only reasonable, logical, scientific conclusion we can come to. Now, the philosophers will get to this point, and they will say, okay, we agree that there had to have been cause. And they may even give it a capital C, okay? Okay, we'll agree with you that there is a cause. There had to have been a cause. We have the effect, so there had to be a cause. But they will argue, and I've heard this done, that there's no reason to believe that that first cause wasn't itself also caused. And they get into this little philosophical game of infinite regression. That, well, yeah, there's an effect here, but there was a cause. Oh, but there's no reason to believe that this
cause wasn't itself caused, and then this was also caused, and they're arguing backwards. And the reason why I think they do that is they like to play the game that, well, let's say I die and I go to see this creator. I'm going to philosophically say, well, yes, you created me, but it's not logical to say that you yourself are not caused. So why should I be accountable to you? This is a comforting rationalization to those who want to avoid accountability. You see, this is the position sometimes of what's known as deism, D-E-I-S-M. Deisms would argue that, yes, there was a God, kind of a big G, generic God, and he created the universe, including all the physical laws and all these phenomena. It's like he wound up the clock and then walked off the stage. And he's no longer involved in this world. He's not reachable. He's not touchable. He's not even on the scene anymore. We're just seeing the cause of this one-time action. He wound up the clock and he's disappeared. Well, that might bring comfort to someone who wants to escape accountability. Through infinite regression, the philosopher argues that it does not logically follow that God is not uncaused by something greater, so he finds comfort in that. Well, here's the chink in the armor. We, of course, argue for an eternal deity. God exists, he always was, he always will be, he's unchanged, the same yesterday, today, and forever. End of story. But even given the premise of this philosophy that God is not himself uncaused, we are still accountable to our Creator, not his. So I can't go up to God and say, well, God, you know, it's logical that you could be created. And he might say to me, perfectly logical, perfectly reasonable. However, I made you and you're accountable to me. So the philosophical show just doesn't work. By regression, the God we encounter still has claims on us as his creations. So in terms of cosmology's Big Bang, something must be eternal. There's no escaping this. The material universe had a beginning and therefore is not eternal, so something immaterial, spiritual, or supernatural must be eternal. It's the only logical, reasonable conclusion we can come to. I love this quote. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. They're just catching up. Now, another argument for the existence of God, another evidence, I believe, is what's called a teleological argument. The word telos or telos can be translated different ways, which we've all become aware of. In the Bible in Romans 10:4, most current English translations translate this, for Christ is the end of the law. That's a favorite one for dispensationalists. Unfortunately, the word telos doesn't really mean end in the meaning of cessation of the law, like they twist it to mean. It really means goal, the consummation. The Greek word telos is used for telephone or telescope. We see something, we see the end of something, it's brought near to us. We see the end, the goal. It's not the cessation of it, it's the end of it. So there is a teleological argument. Is the universe and life designed? Is there a goal of it all? Is there purpose behind it? This is a pretty strong argument. We have what's called a just right universe. Out of 51 fine-tuned parameters to our galaxy system, solar system and planet, the very distance from the sun, from Earth, is just right. If it was any closer, we'd burn up. If it was any farther away, we'd freeze. It's just perfect. The size, temperature, the type of the sun is just right. The size, the axial tilt of the Earth, which gives us our season, the rotation speed, the fact that we have a moon that exerts influence on our oceans, that provides tides, which are so important to us, all of these things are orchestrated to preserve life, without which it wouldn't exist. So we have this perfectly just right universe. Everything has a purpose, a design. How can that be if it was just chance? If it was just random? A couple of electrons bumped into each other and poof, all this happens? Do we see purpose and design here? Of course. Jupiter acts as a comet, an asteroid magnet, shielding the Earth from catastrophic collisions. Our sun is located between spiral arms of the Milky Way galaxy where there are fewer stars, so we have less harmful radiation and disruptive gravity. Everything is pretty stable here. And because we have less gas and dust, we can see the rest of the galaxy and the universe and see the glories of God. He's left us, the screen is open. We can see if we can see. To get this just right universe mathematically, 10^-166 power is the probability of all 123 fine-tuned parameters occurring just by chance. Figure the odds on that one and roll the dice. Is this going to happen by chance, or is there design and purpose behind it all? One scientist said, as we survey all the evidence, the thought insistently arises that some supernatural agency, or rather agency with a capital A, must be involved. Is it possible that suddenly, without intending to, we have stumbled upon scientific proof of the existence of a supreme being? The astrophysicists who are faithful to the evidence know the truth. If we need an atheist for a debate, I go to the philosophy department. The physics department isn't much use. They get it. They understand. God doesn't play dice with the universe. That's a quote from Einstein. Design and purpose in the universe and in all creation. Will the one who planted the ear not hear? Will the one who formed the eye not see? One of the things my relative Christoph Scheiner got right, I mean, I got to give him credit for this one. He wrote a treatise on the human eye. I think it was written in Latin. And he argued the existence of God from the design and function of the human eye. And he was spot on. How is it possible that this a fantastic instrument can do all the things it does and there's not a designer behind it? It's just a nonsensical argument. So Christoph got that one right. The Bible says the heavens declare the glory of God. The dome of the sky speaks the work of his hands. Every day it utters speech. Every night it reveals knowledge. We only have to look if we have eyes to see. It is the worldly philosopher who is blinded by his own willful arrogance and presuppositional bias. Darwinism can be refuted in many ways. One is by irreducible complexity. Mike Behe introduced the concept of irreducible complexity in his book, Darwin's Black Box. What he's saying is something is irreducibly complex if it is comprised of two or more necessary parts. If you remove one part and then function is not just impaired but destroyed. The basic theory behind evolution is that as this organism somehow knows it has need of legs, it will start growing these things, right? Well, until they become fully functional, they're actually an impediment to its prior existence. So by the very law of natural selection would require it to shed it as an impediment because it's not necessary for its existence at that point. A mousetrap is irreducibly complex. You can refute Darwinism with a mousetrap. Consider the mousetrap. There are five basic components to a mousetrap. You've got the body, the platform, right? You have to have that to put all the parts on. You have a holding bar, a spring, a catch, and a hammer. All five parts are essential, and they have to be present at the same time for any of the pieces to have any functional meaning. So we pull the hammer back and place the holding bar above it. We take the spring, and the spring now has this potential energy in it. And then, and when the catch is released, then the potential energy becomes kinetic energy, and the hammer comes over and does its job. But you can't build a mousetrap by natural selection. It's impossible, because it has no function to select until all five parts are there together. So for complex organisms with multiple parts, all interdependent, would have to spring into existence with all parts functioning. It couldn't be gradual, because the very parts necessary for the other parts to have meaning would require, by the very dictates of Darwinism, that they be jettisoned. So the whole theory falls apart when you examine it just from a logical, scientific base. A mousetrap cannot be built by natural selection. It's been said that the early bird may get the worm, but the second mouse gets the cheese. Sorry. Our body is this high-tech cellular factory. It does amazing things. If you study biology, there's artificial languages and decoding. There's central memory banks. Our brain is an incredible device. Sometimes I got to reboot mine, but nonetheless, it's incredible. I need a defrag it tube. We have precision control of automatic assembly. There's proofreading and quality control. There's prefabrication and modular construction of cellular pieces that connect together and tissues and things that all form together for a purpose. And it's very complex. There's a complete replication system. Our cells reproduce and they know exactly what to do. And 10^-3 times smaller than our best computers. Astounding. We examine just human biology. How can we not come to the conclusion that there is a creator, a designer, with infinite detail? Finally, there's a moral argument. Is there a law written on our hearts? Moral laws imply a moral law giver. There is an objective moral law. Now, philosophers, again, don't like this. If there is an objective moral law, there has to be an objective moral law giver. But whose morality? Isn't mine just as good as yours? We hear this moral relativism today. Well, let's take a look at this. Moral laws are, first of all, different than natural laws. They're natural laws of physics, for example. Those we can measure, that's the scientific method. We can take a look at that. Moral laws are different because they describe what ought to be, not what is. We have an innate sense within us to know that ain't right. We know what this should be. It should be better. How do we know that? Where does that come from? We just make it up? No. Human beings all over the earth have this curious idea that they ought to behave in a certain way and cannot really get rid of it. I like C.S. Lewis's quote. He's a good thinker. Most of us have some kind of a conscience. We have some kind of inner conviction that this is good, this is bad, or this is not good, this could be better. We have this internally to it. We respond to reality this way. Not everyone does. There are sociopaths in this world. That's unfortunate. But most of us have some sense of what right and wrong is. We don't want to lose that. Is it possible to lose that sense? Unfortunately, yes. Some people can continue down a path of self-destruction and rebellion and get to a point where the Bible talks about a depraved heart, a debased mind. And they can go so far that they just are insensitive to moral issues anymore. That's very sad. There is an objective moral law. If no set of moral ideas were truer or better than any other, there would be no sense in preferring civilized morality to savage morality or Christian morality to Nazi morality. In fact, of course, we all do believe that some moralities are better than others. The moment you say that one set of moralities, moral ideas are better than another, you are first, in fact, measuring them both by a standard. This is a very powerful argument to use against the moral relativist that, well, you know, we can't be dogmatic here. You know, everybody has their truth and there's, you know, this, what's wrong with this? And this person has their moral viewpoint too. In our debate with moral relativists, we can always go to some real morality. If we push the argument far enough, comparing them both with some real morality, admitting that there is such a thing as a real right, independent of what people think, and that some people's ideas get nearer to that real right than others. Again, C.S. Lewis. I could debate someone who's a moral relativist who says, well, you know, that's your morality, and I have my morality, and that's all well and good, and we're all happy people. Okay, let's play a little experiment. This is my little kingdom here. I own this. I am the king of this little world here, and you've just transgressed my kingdom. I'm going to kill you. Well, you can't do that. Why? Well, it's wrong. According to who? That's my morality. But it's wrong. Maybe it's wrong to you, but it's not wrong to me. You're in my kingdom now. This is my authority. You're on my property. But it's wrong. Why? You see the argument? At some point, even the moral relativist has to admit that there's something beyond this little back and forth thing. There's some higher morality that would argue, no, that's wrong. Was September 11th wrong? That's a great argument. Of course it was wrong. It was horrifying. So many innocent people who died needlessly. Was it wrong? Yes, absolutely. It was evil. But the moral relativist would say, well, not for that culture. They were just following the dictates of their heart. Really? Was the Holocaust wrong? I mean, after all, Hitler was in power. He called the shots. Doesn't the moral relativist argument work there? Shouldn't we give him his right to be whatever he wants in his country? You see, at some point, even the relativist thinker has to rethink it. No, there is some higher law that we must accept. If there is such a universal objective moral law, then there must be a moral lawgiver. It has to come from somewhere. Now, there's a very good inductive argument. If anything now exists, we can agree that it exists. It's not an illusion. An illusion exists in the mind of the person suffering from it. We're not all sharing the same illusion, are we? That would really stretch chance, wouldn't it? If anything now exists, then something must be eternal, or something not eternal must have emerged from nothing. Does that sound very scientific? Kind of silly when you put it that way. It has been shown that it is more reasonable, more logical, more scientific, and more rational to believe that something is eternal. I argue for the God of the Bible. But philosophically, I can leave that for another debate. But I believe the God of the Bible is the most reasonable option. So in summary, life without God is absurd. What's the point? It makes no sense. The universe requires a sufficient cause with a capital C. The design of the universe and living things implies a designer. Our universal sense of right and wrong, which we share, implies a lawgiver, a source for that moral law. Therefore, belief in God is reasonable. What is life like without God? There's a phrase in the Bible that comes up a lot. You might want to do a phrase search sometimes. But God. The story of Joseph forgiving his brothers. You meant to do me harm, but God meant it for good, so that it would come about as it is today, with many people's lives being saved. The evil intents of the heart of sinful man toward us are turned around by the sovereignty and omnipotence of God to work good according to his purposes. Psalm 49, this is the manner of life of the foolish and those who come after, approving their words. Like sheep, they are destined for Sheol. Death will be their shepherd. The upright will rule them in the morning, and their forms will waste away in Sheol until they need no dwelling. But God will redeem me from Sheol's control, because he will receive me. God redeems us not only from the curse, but from the control and fear that death brings. We are not under the control of fear of death. Psalm 73, 26, my mind and body may fail, but God, is the rock for my mind and my portion forever. Even within the experience of our failing minds and bodies, we have a secure place to put our mind and body and our future. This is not fantasy. This is not denial. This is not wish fulfillment. This is a very present reality. The Bible says in 1 Corinthians 2, 9 and 10, eye hath not seen nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for them that love him. But God has revealed them unto us by his Spirit. We have the privilege of incredible revelation from God about our future. Romans 5, 7, and 8. Now it is a rare event when someone gives up his life, even for the sake of somebody righteous. Although possibly for a truly good person, one might have the courage to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in that the Messiah died on our behalf while we were still sinners. While we were still sinners and not even looking for God, he redeemed us. What does it mean to have God in our lives? Messiah is our sacrifice. He took our sins upon himself. He was our guilt offering. He was raised from the dead as our accepted sacrifice. He died once and for all on our behalf. God's wrath against us has been fully met in the atonement of Messiah. God legally declares us acquitted of our sins. There is no more guilt and condemnation. God broke the bonds of our slavery to sin and purchased or ransomed us for himself, making us his bondservants. God delivered and rescued us from the death penalty passed on to us by our sins. We are saved in the past from the penalty of sin. We are saved in the present from the power of sin. And we shall be saved in the future from the presence of sin. We have reconciliation, peace with God. It's really a binary decision, this whole philosophical debate. God or no God. That's it. Consider the words of Moshe as he spoke to the children of Israel on the plains of Moab as they were preparing to enter the promised land. Look, I am presenting you today with, on the one hand, life and good, and on the other, death and evil. In that I am ordering you today to love Adonai your God, to follow his ways, and to obey his mitzvot, regulations, and rulings, for if you do, you will live, and increase your numbers, and Adonai your God will bless you in the land you are entering in order to take possession of it. But if your heart turns away, if you refuse to listen, if you are drawn away to prostrate yourself before other gods and serve them, I am announcing to you today that you will certainly perish. You will not live long in the land you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess. I call on heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have presented you with life and death, the blessing and the curse. Therefore, choose life so that you will live, you and your descendants, loving Adonai, your God, paying attention to what he says and clinging to him. For that is the purpose of your life. Shabbat Shalom. Asked our brother Paul to come up.